Ignition sequence start. 3, 2, 1. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
Welcome back to University, everybody, the podcast where we're exploring the hard-hitting questions of Earth, existence, and the unknown. I'm AJ Perrin, your host. With me, as always, is
Judson Martin.
And today, I'm going to open up my notes first before I start talking out my, you know, my butt. Let's do the episode intro first. Give people the cliffhanger before we move into all the other stuff, right?
Sounds good.
Okay, how many times on this show have we said that innovation always starts in the military?
Sometimes we've mentioned it. A few.
Yeah. Definitely in the computing episode.
There was quite a bit.
I remember that one. Computing.
Yeah, computing.
Anyway, this is especially true for long-range communications. So picture this. 1960s, height of the Cold War, amidst all the tensions of the era, a clandestine military project is underway, shrouded in secrecy. Its goal? Nothing short of revolutionizing international communication and ushering in a new era of safety, reliability, and rapid response to global conflict. What emerged from this covert initiative would not only redefine satellite technology, but also leave an indelible mark on the laws governing space. Welcome to the world of Project Westford. You know who wrote
indelible.
That?
Indelible. Who?
ChatGPT. That's why I got to the word indelible.
What does
and
that
I
mean?
Was like, what is that?
Yeah.
I think indelible means, and I wrote this episode kind of script or outline a long time ago, but I do remember checking to make sure it was a word because I was like, am I going to pronounce that right? Is there a different way to pronounce that? Indelible? I don't know. Indelible would be like undeniable.
Gotcha.
Or impactful.
Okay.
I'm guessing. That's really just using context clues. I have no idea what it means.
You didn't look it up.
I just made sure. No, I looked up the pronunciation. You know, on Google, you have the lady read you the word out loud.
Oh, okay.
Exactly. But first, let's jump into news and brain gains. That was the end of that. I actually wrote that one. ChatGPT couldn't add that flourish.
Of course not.
Let's take a pause. It just feels good to be back on the show. I know we were going to record this last weekend, but like now I'm feeling ultra prepared to talk about this stuff.
Ready to go?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And if this, to be honest, if this episode doesn't kind of blow you away completely, I would be really surprised. In my opinion, this is one of the most... This is one of those episodes where a couple things we've talked about or a couple things that just are general science knowledge come together in some interesting ways. Make the clicks, the aha moments are like left and right.
I learned a lot from this one, I'll say.
Second to the entropy episode, maybe.
Yeah, and that one was all thanks to
aided by the Tim Cullinan, Dr. Tim Cullinan.
I got some news. So something that happened a little bit ago now, I guess. This was when we were going to record originally, but Voyager 1 has reestablished contact, or is established coherent contact with NASA. So for the last 8 months, Voyager 1's been sending signals to Earth that weren't, they were
coherent.
Incoherent. They weren't
Whoa,
correct.
We matched there for a second.
They weren't making sense. So then NASA has been trying to send signals to kind of reset the computers on board and to get Voyager 1 to be able to send good signals back. And obviously, that takes a very long time when Voyager 1 is billions of miles away. So that signal has to travel through space and time. So it takes, or it, through space, which takes time.
Yeah, what was the, I have it written down somewhere, like how long it takes to get there and then get back is double that, obviously. It's like 26 hours, maybe at this point,
for
those
much,
signals to travel.
It's definitely longer than that.
Definitely, he says. All right, let's look it up. 22.5 hours.
Okay.
Man, you had some confidence.
I thought
you had
to be longer.
Fire behind
I
that.
I thought that was on the magnitude of like days or something.
I mean, it's 15 billion miles, so it makes sense to...
Almost a light day away.
Yeah.
I guess it can't be billions of miles away then.
It is. It's 15 billion miles away. But light travels at like 3 billion meters a second or so. No, well, that's not right.
No, that is right.
And it's three. It can't be 3 billion miles a second would get there in.
That's 80 million, is it?
Let's just pause.
Anywho,
I'm gonna blur all this math out. If you're hearing this right now, that's because we had an incoherent math discussion, but we landed on light travels at 300 million
meters
a second.
Per second.
Boom.
But we're talking in miles.
Yeah.
For
so not even worth it. Out of scope, to be honest.
So it's 1,600 meters in a mile.
Right there.
Which means
if we couldn't do 10 to the 8th, we need to get ourselves under the reins. Anyway, keep talking about Voyager here.
That's it.
Oh, okay.
NASA sent some signals, got it figured out.
We
now
got it
it's giving data back, which is cool because it's far away, and so it can tell us things that no one's ever seen before.
I heard that the tech in your car key, your car fob, there's more computing power in your car fob these days than was on Voyager.
I'd imagine, yeah.
I would.
Maybe I would, in like a Tesla one or something.
Yeah, like a really high end.
Tesla doesn't even.
But who knows? I'm not saying that's a real fact. That's something people tend to say these days. Do you remember what the problem was on it? I think it was like a component issue, like a piece of a chip shorted out or finished its age. But the way they had to work around it, since that's a hardware issue, but they can only do software things, is they had to rewrite their code to basically work around that.
Not use that part somehow?
Exactly.
Interesting.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, so Boeing Starliner. If you guys are unfamiliar with that, let's first compare it to something, okay? SpaceX Crew Dragon spacecraft. That is a spacecraft that takes groups to and from the International Space Station. It was part of, let me find it, the Commercial Crew Program for NASA. But SpaceX wasn't the only person developing a spacecraft for this purpose. Boeing was also doing the same thing at the same time.
Right.
The only difference is that SpaceX has been operating their Crew Dragon for the last 4 years, and Boeing Starliner has never operated their spacecraft, their Boeing Starliner, right? My point is, after years of setbacks, Boeing Starliner will be taking flight as soon as May 6th, which is the day that this episode comes out. So,
what's the mission?
Kind of magical.
What are they doing?
Doing the same thing that Crew Dragon does, which is just taking people to and from the International Space Station. The reason that NASA ever had two, I wouldn't call them contracts, like companies building the same thing, is because you want to be able to rely on one if the other has a failure, and you don't want to make two identical ones, because if one fails, you could expect the same failure out of the other one.
Yeah, and I mean,
so they're meant to be backups to each other.
It also drives competition, innovation, that sort of thing too.
Yeah. The race between these two companies took a pretty clear turn in 2020 because there was a Starliner flight test that year, but there was a huge issue where Starliner wasn't able to dock to the International Space Station. And part of the issue was the spaceship's internal clock was 11 hours off. Which we talked about that one episode, maybe one or two ago, about how they need to create a lunar time.
Yeah.
Well, part of the reason that's necessary is so we don't have misalignments in computer systems.
Right.
It's actually like a issue, you know. Seems silly. Something as like as simple as a clock can be part of the reason you can't dock an entire space station or to a space station.
But yeah.
There's the Boeing Starliner news. As soon as May 6th, we're going to see that up in the air. And Boeing has assured us that it's air ready, space ready, and the astronauts that are going to be on board, longtime NASA veterans, are confident in it as well. So
Boeing's having a rough go right now.
Yeah, you know what?
They'll recover.
You know what? You remember what we were talking at that dinner a couple weeks ago? And remember the conversation we had? The pendulum kind of swings both ways.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the attention will be over here for a little bit, and the attention will be over here. And we're not worried about quality until all of a sudden we're worried about quality again. And we're looking at these people, this is the problem, and now this is the problem, whatever. And that's real, especially in this situation, because NASA even admitted at some point that they were like, yeah, SpaceX is kind of unorthodox in what they do or how they operate. And so they were paying much more attention to SpaceX and giving it much more scrutiny as Crew Dragon was being built than they were to Boeing, because Boeing has a very traditional approach similar to NASA's.
Sure.
Right, so it swings. Cool. Moving on, man.
In other space news, China has launched a historic mission to gather rock samples on the dark side of the moon, which is pretty sweet. So the dark side of the moon is the side of the moon that Earth never sees, but it'll be cool to see if those rock samples are any different. I don't know the full intention of the mission, if they believe some difference, but it'll be cool. So that rocket took off on May 3rd. This is China's largest rocket, the Long March 5.
Yeah.
Don't know. So it launched on May 3rd, but it's called the March 5.
Yeah. Was that last? Make sense. Is May 3rd?
Today.
Oh my, it launched today?
Yeah. The day of this recording.
Wow. Yeah, the day of this recording, right? So it'll be last Friday for you guys. I read that the crater that this lander is going to land in. By the way, this is a sample return.
This is unmanned mission, yeah.
Yeah, unmanned sample return. The interesting thing is we've sent probes to the dark side of the moon before, and we've also, we have a, what is it, a lunar reconnaissance orbiter from NASA that constantly orbits. So we've seen the other side of the moon. We know a little bit about it, but if we have a sample return, then we can have the big heavy hitting equipment check out some samples from it. So,
and the cool thing about this is these probes and things, when they go to the dark side of the moon, they have to act with a certain level of autonomy, meaning because communications are hard to get through the moon.
Yeah.
Because we don't see the moon. So it has to go through, which means the robot kind of has to act on its own almost entirely, meaning, you know, these are some cool technologies.
Yeah. And it's in a crater that's 5 miles deep. It's the biggest crater on the moon, and it takes up a quarter of the entire surface.
Yeah, that's big.
I think the thing that I would like out of the mission is, remember when we talked on our moon episode and we said that the side of the moon that faces us has a thicker crust than the side on the other or on the far side? That's what I would like these samples to explain is why that is. Because I think that's still unknown to a certain degree. I'd also like to know why. We know that the moon is tidally locked, but we don't know why the moon is tidally locked. Interesting fact. We don't have an explanation for why. We just know that it is.
The mission will collect 4.4 pounds of rock. So it's surprisingly small.
What do they say in deep rock? Rock or whatever. Rock and stone.
Rock and stone. Nice. So, yeah, that's a surprisingly small sample, I think, but I guess they'll learn a lot from it. So,
yeah.
What do you got next?
So the other one I was going to talk about is the University of Milan was doing some interesting research. Do you know what a wheel of death is?
No. Sounds fun.
It's, yeah, a blast if you're on a motorcycle and can drive fast enough.
Oh, okay.
Does that ring a bell now?
Sure.
So they go up. It's a horizontal wall or close to horizontal. They drive up with enough speed, and then if they keep driving fast enough, they can stay on the wall, right? So they're basically parallel to the ground. So the University of Milan is like, how are astronauts going to stay fit on the moon? Well, if the moon has 1/6 of the gravity, it's likely that you could run fast enough to exhibit this effect on like just your own 2 feet.
Interesting.
So that might be a way that we do it. In all fairness, that doesn't seem reasonable at all when we already have very small, compact ways to stay fit like we use on the ISS. Why would we make it even bigger
and
larger scale?
Because it would be cool.
It'd be awesome. But also at the same time, it's like the moon even has gravity. The ISS has found ways to stay fit in microgravity.
Like when I send my Hot Wheels through the loop of death, as you're talking about, right. I think it looks pretty sweet.
Yeah.
And so,
it'd be pretty cool to see,
see a human doing it just by running would be fun.
Yeah. It would be, it'd make for a cool video. Anyway, that's it for, what is that? News. That's
news.
It for news. Let's move on to brain gains today.
Sweet. So, earlier this week, I kind of learned, or I've been seeing Greenland sharks on my TikTok For You page quite a bit recently. These are the longest living sharks in the water, the longest living animal with a vertebrae, actually. So they live from 250 to 500 years, which is pretty crazy. That's a long time. That means that there's been sharks alive since, I don't even know, what happened in the last 500 years. Columbus was not seen by the same Greenland sharks as you and I, but
it's just crazy. Like the American Revolution is the first one that comes to mind, 1700s. French Revolution, that was even later, I guess. Trying to think of anything that happened in the 1600s. I can't think of anything. You know what's funny is when you said Greenland sharks, it took me so long to remember that you've already told me this in the past. I was like, Greenland sharks, why do I know what a Greenland shark is? Yeah. Anyway, my brain gains is, so Star Wars, everybody knows, everybody, gotta be careful when you say the word everybody. It's pretty commonly known that in Star Wars, like the explosions that happened in space and the laser blasts and everything, you would not hear them, right?
Sure.
That's known.
Yeah. Sound needs to propagate through a material or some sort of medium.
It's a mechanical wave.
Yes,
yeah, exactly.
Nothing in space.
It's not on the electromagnetic spectrum. It needs actual like matter to move through versus if you're an energy wave like light or ultraviolet.
Yeah, anything on the electromagnetic spectrum.
Yeah. Then you can travel through the vacuum. Knowing that, also you wouldn't be able to see the lasers because what is the light reflecting off of? Yes, the light from a laser could travel from one ship to the other,
Sure.
It could travel to your retina, for example, right? So if you're staring straight down the barrel of the laser from one chip to another, you could see that laser, but that's only when it hits your eye. You wouldn't see it travel through from the vacuum of space.
You wouldn't see it travel to exactly. the ship, but you would see it
hit the ship. Because it would reflect off the ship
and excite the light particles.
Or yeah, exactly.
To
or,
bounce off of. Okay. Yeah. I can see where you're going.
Yeah, because we can see the sun, but the sun doesn't cast this like giant light ray from it to the surface of our planet. So same thing with the Death Star then. The Death Star wouldn't have this like charged up laser that then and then the planet.
Interesting.
So it makes the movie a lot less interesting if you watch it with just like you see real the spaceships physics. Blow up and stuff. And that's to say that you could create a laser weapon. As far as I know, that seems like it'd be pretty difficult.
I mean, yeah, but we're doing it. We're making, that's how one plan to get space junk.
Oh, yeah. But isn't that more about like interfering with enough to like slow it down, not like blow it up?
I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's a space that'd be laser.
That'd be an even more lame Star Wars movie is if they're just shooting each other to like slightly slow each other down with lasers. But yeah. Let's take a break and move on to talk about Project Westford. Secret military experiment.
Sweet.
All right, gang, welcome back to the show. Judd, did you get to hear the new intro music?
Yeah, the one from
did you get to hear it mixed into the show?
Yeah, I listened to one of that because when you told me you made it, it's
pretty
cool.
Nice, isn't it?
I like it.
I like it a lot, dude. I was like, just at the top of the show, I was thinking, I was like, when I say welcome back to university, I'll have been coming in right after that.
Yeah,
that's a good feeling. And just that break, did you listen to the break music?
I don't know if I listened to that.
Let me put you on real quick, okay? Everybody else just heard it, but I'm gonna break right here just so you can listen to it. It brings an energy. That's what I heard from a couple people actually that sent me messages about it. Is they were like, it brings more energy into the show. I hoped we had it already. So
yeah.
Anyway, today we're talking about Project Westford, which was a secret military experiment to revolutionize international communication. And so there's a couple things if we want to frame this story correctly, we need to understand a couple basic things about how communication, modern and old communication, works. Let's first talk about the thing that allows radios to exist in the first place, and that is what's known as the ionosphere. You may have heard of the troposphere, lithosphere, stratosphere, exosphere. The ionosphere is like none of these things because it's not a distinct separation or distinct level of the atmosphere.
Right.
It is bands within those layers.
Right.
And the thing that distinguishes the ionosphere is it includes a high number of electrically charged atoms and molecules. And I say electrically charged because UV rays and energy from the sun hit these molecules within these layers and free up electrons.
Yeah, they'll hit the electrons and knock them out of place.
Exactly. And the really important part of, or the really important feature of the ionosphere is how dense those free electrons are at any given time. And that plays a role in how the radios work.
For radio communication. Yeah, so these electrons get knocked out of their orbit and their atoms, and then they'll pretty quickly regain in within another atom. But in that time that they're free, they're able to be hit by radio waves, as we'll discuss later.
Now, there's a couple different layers, but there's kind of two sections that are important for the ionosphere. There's the upper one. The upper one is about 220 to 300 kilometers above the surface of the Earth. That's beyond what we even call the limit of space, right?
100 kilometers of space.
Anyway, so 220 to 300 is the top layer, and then 70 to 100 is the lower band ionosphere. Now, like Judd said, these free electrons will recombine within these layers, but it happens more often in the lower layers than in the upper layers, because the upper layers, the density of air molecules is less in the first place, and so it's harder for the electrons to recombine because they have to first find another thing.
Yeah, and so if there's less ions going around that need an electron, then it's going to be harder for those electrons to find one.
Yeah. So the upper ionosphere is pretty much day and night charged with free electrons because, like we just said, it's harder for these electrons to recombine. At the lower levels, they are more charged during the day because what's out during the day, Judd?
The sun.
The sun, right? And then it goes away at night. And so that lower ionosphere kind of recombines itself, reconfigures, and becomes a little less charged. And that plays a key role here in radio communications, which we'll get into. Now let's jump into how radio frequencies work. Radio frequency is a part of the electromagnetic spectrum. So they are actual energy waves that are traveling. They're not like sound waves that we talked about at the start, right? The Star Wars brain gains was like kind of cleverly timed to talk about mechanical waves versus energy waves. But radio waves are energy waves that travel in straight lines. So unless, Judd, like I'm holding a radio and you're holding a transmitter, unless I can see you, right? Eyesight transmission or straight line transmission, I forget what they call it, then our radios can't communicate because we can't see each other. However, because of the ionosphere, we can bounce radio waves of certain frequencies off of the ionosphere and back down to a transmitter. That's what's called sky wave propagation. So it bounces between the ionosphere and the ground several times until it reaches more transmitters.
Right.
Within the range of radio frequencies, there's what's known as the radio window. And the radio window means the stuff that won't get bounced off and will pass through, just like light through a window.
Mm-hmm.
So lower frequencies, let me see where I wrote this down.
Yeah, so and I think it's important to note, it's there's a lot of different things that a wave has to get through in order to pass all the way through.
Yeah. So at really low frequencies, we're able to bounce those frequencies off of the ionospheres because it's easy enough for that energy to be absorbed by the free electrons and for those electrons to oscillate within that same frequency and send that energy back down to Earth, right? That's how you can imagine that bouncing happening. It's the electron essentially catching that energy and then redistributing it back towards the planet.
You're saying that's easier at higher or lower?
Lower.
At lower frequencies because or lower it's wavelengths.
Higher or longer wavelengths.
Longer wavelengths.
Because it happens less frequently.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Longer wavelength means less frequency. Once we start moving that frequency up into the radio window, eventually that's too much energy for those electrons to capture and redistribute or oscillate at those frequencies. And so that becomes the radio window where stuff is passing through. A good example of something that uses the radio window, again, these things stop becoming what we call conventional radios and become other things like the internet, right? Or satellite communications, GPS. These are all things that use the radio window because they pass through the lower ionosphere and even sometimes the upper ionosphere to get caught by a satellite. And then that satellite sends it back down, that information back down to where it needs to go.
Sure.
Another example of something that uses the radio window is astronomy or radio telescopes.
Yeah.
So if we want to catch radio waves from space, we're catching those frequencies that are within the radio window. Sometimes when the frequency gets too high, though, we start running into a different problem, which is we're getting absorbed by actual molecules in the atmosphere. Like actual gases will be hit by these radio waves and it'd be blocked. The way I like to think of this is when we're at the in the radio window, they can pass through the electrons, but as soon as the frequency gets too fast, we start actually being obstructed by physical matter, just like light, right? Light is way, way, way faster of a frequency than radio waves. And can light pass through a wall? No.
Right.
So once we start getting up into those really high frequencies, the physical obstructions become a problem. But it's the low frequencies that can pass through things. Radio waves can pass through physical matter. Same thing with sound.
Right, because like you said, visible light is a much higher or much lower wavelength and much higher frequency.
Yeah.
And like you said, it can't go through the wall. So
yeah, it's a long-winded explanation for me to say exactly that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
Let's start diving into Project Westford. First off, communications in the 60s, this is when this took place, early 60s, communications prior to this, how do you think they communicated with like Great Britain or someone across the ocean?
They did underwater cables, right?
Exactly. Yeah. That is so bizarre to me. It's like, I don't know. I thought phones, even when they were old phones, could still call across the ocean, right? Right.
I mean,
wrong.
Today, even like the internet is a lot of fiber optic cables underwater as well. So mm-hmm. it's still something that we're doing.
However, during this time, the military was kind of unsatisfied with the idea of just running cables underwater. I can see why. You know, they don't want them to just get cut right before a major event happens on the other side of the world that they need to know about and respond to.
Right.
So they're like, let's make some better radios that can communicate across the sea. At this time, it was well known that the lower frequency radios were able to bounce off the ionosphere and build these communication lines. So why did they not want to use these low frequencies? I have a couple guesses. Now, let me just say they were targeting about 8 gigahertz, which is typically within the radio window.
Right.
This is a frequency that would otherwise pass through the ionosphere. Why would they ever want this for radio communications? The reason they wanted to use this range is because of a couple things I'm going to guess at, which is first, if you have a higher frequency, you can have more data packed into each packet, whatever you want to call it, right? The bandwidth of data.
Each second, yeah.
Exactly. Also,
it'd be important to note that like frequency, when we're talking about frequency, we're talking about a hertz.
Yeah.
That means that's one oscillation per second. And so these radio waves, either AM meaning amplitude modulation or FM meaning frequency modulation, if we make one of the amplitudes larger than the other one, then we have created two different things that we can distinguish between, let's say a one and a zero, meaning we could transmit in binary.
Yeah.
So if we're able to fit more, if we're operating at a higher frequency, we're able to fit more ones and zeros every second.
Yeah.
And so that's what's important to note.
Okay. Yeah. So 8 gigahertz is in the radio frequency. Why do they want to use this? First of all, more data. Second of all, at low frequencies, right, before we perfected, I would say, modern radio communications that we use internationally, before we perfected that, it was very hard to get a clean signal at low frequencies from the other side of the world for a couple of reasons. One, the way that radios perform is different during the day and during the night, because during the night, the sun goes away and the lower band of the ionosphere reconfigures. That means radio signals are more likely to hit the upper one and bounce down. That's good. Radios, actually, this is a fun fact. Radios perform extremely well at night. And that's because the low band kind of becomes less charged and you can bounce off of a higher ceiling and go further.
Yeah, go further.
And also there's just generally noise, lots of noise in our world that could interfere with these low signals. So before we were able to perfect it, things like storms. So lightning in the sky can affect how well these radio signals are received.
Lightning's got a lot of electrons.
Exactly. And also noise, like if you're transmitting from one industrial city to the other, it's going to get a little muddy because there are other things that in our world that transmit or have a frequency,
right?
These low frequencies, electricity things, engines, things like that are going to create noise that can get picked up by your radio receiver. It's not just a radio transmitter that can create things on the electromagnetic spectrum. So they're like, until we perfect these radios, we need to up this frequency if I want to be able to talk to somebody on the other side of the world. But it's within the radio window. And so what do they say that they're going to do in order to make an artificial radio or radio wall to bounce off of?
They're going to throw some needles in the sky.
They're going to throw what they wanted to at the time to be billions of needles to make a band in the sky to bounce these high frequencies off of.
Right.
The project Westford was presumably named after Westford, Massachusetts, because this project took place at MIT. It was actually originally called Project Needles. And you can pretty much understand why. It's because they were going to make a band in the sky of needles.
Yeah. And these needles were about 1.7 centimeters long and 1 mil, which means 1/1000 of an inch thick.
Yeah.
So pretty small, but that size is very important for that 8 gigahertz range that you or frequency that you were talking about, because the wavelength of an 8 gigahertz signal is half or double that frequency.
Exactly.
Yes. That wavelength. Sorry.
Yeah. If you can imagine like a wave in the ocean and you put the wavelength would be the distance from the top of one wave to the top of the next, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you have a surfboard that's that length, how are you going to ride in between those waves? You're sitting on top of the wave. You know, the perfect surfboard length becomes half that wave when your surfboard is never either being tipped up by the wave in front of you or tipped, the back of it is tipped up by the wave behind you. No, it's fitting perfectly within those oscillations. And so that's why half is like the optimal size, because you have the biggest area that these radio waves can bounce off of without being too long. So yeah, that has something to do with what's called resonance, which is a pretty much a deeper topic, but it has to do with how these needles will actually enhance the strength of these radio waves.
Yeah, resonance is how your car, let's say your car, you're listening to the radio in your car. There's a lot of radio waves traveling through you or the earth at any second. If you set your signal to 106.3 FM, then...
What radio station is that in Nebraska, man?
That's, I don't remember the name of it, but that's...
That is the station you've listened to?
Yeah. Nice. Anyways, your car is able to pick out just that radio wave because of resonance. Your car will search for that radio signal, and when it finds that, it starts vibrating your antenna in your car. Once your car is vibrating at the resonant frequency of that wave, your car amplifies that signal and is able to just stay with it. So then all the other signals become small and irrelevant to your car. So it's only listening to that.
Yeah. So did this project, Project Westford, actually end up happening? The short answer is yes. So October 1961, they launched the first 100 million needles, but unfortunately they didn't disperse them correctly. So they had to reschedule for another batch of needles to go up. But 2 years later, May 1963, it actually worked. So the U.S. Launched 350 million of these needles, these dipoles. Yeah. It was about 50 per square mile, which might not seem like it's very dense, but this was actually enough to accurately reflect these 8 gigahertz radio frequencies back to the ground. And so they were actually quite successful. The reason, though, that we don't still have these needles up today, in case you're wondering, there is no ring of needles, unfortunately, these days anymore. And that's because the U.S. actually got an extreme amount of backlash for doing this. That's because at this time, there was no outer space treaty. There was no, what were some of the other ones we talked about last episode? Liability convention?
Yeah, there's rules to what you can just put up in space or the atmosphere. Yeah.
But there wasn't at that point. Time, yeah. And so people were like, not only just people worldwide, people in the U.S. were like, this just doesn't seem right.
One group of people that was particularly upset about this experiment were scientists or astronomers because, like we said, these things pick up radio signals. So radio telescopes would not be effective in this area because the needles would impact the signal that they receive.
Yeah, exactly. Also, the U.S. at the time had launched a couple other satellite projects that were just unhinged before this outer space treaty happened. For example, they detonated a nuke in space in the early 1960s. They detonated a nuke on the second attempt of a mission. The first attempt, the nuke didn't make it all the way to space, and so they detonated that thing at 30,000 feet. And all of that radioactive stuff just dispersed itself into the atmosphere. And so the U.S. had a huge track record of like major no-nos when it comes to how we're treating the space above other countries. And so that was, the needles was the tipping point, you know, where people were like, it's time to start some conversations about this, which would eventually lead to the Outer Space Treaty, which we talked about last episode. In fact, it was last episode's research that helped me find this project, which, if I could give us a pat on the back, I couldn't find a single other podcast that has talked about this.
We're the first.
Maybe, you know, just going to throw it out there. Maybe I was kind of blurring my eyes when I was doing the search or not typing the full project name just to give myself some confirmation bias. But I like to believe that.
So are we the first or are we not?
I think we were. Let's double check.
Jeez.
Let's see. Project Westford. Heck yeah, dude. I don't see another, no.
Cool.
It's us. We are the Project Westford episode. Who said this? Maybe this will ring a bell with you, Jed. If something doesn't exist.
I do remember this, but I don't know where it came
from. If something cool, good in this earth doesn't exist without you doing it, it's your responsibility to make it happen. And so this episode didn't exist until we were here to explain to you how the U.S. put hundreds of millions of needles in the sky. kind of the final thoughts on Project Westford, you know, what happened to it? How these needles get out of the sky? Well, there was a 5-year obsolescence planned into these needles. So they were supposed to come down within 5 years based off their orbit. However, today, still a few dozen clumps still exist, but as you can imagine, they're tracked pretty closely by organizations here on the ground to ensure that they don't collide with our current spacecraft. Military satellites pretty much quickly replaced the need for these needles. Within a couple years, actually, of this project in 1963, which is hilarious to me. It's like, imagine you're the engineers in the early 60s that are loading hundreds of millions of these tiny pins into a spacecraft to launch them. And then like 2-3 years later, NASA's like, guys, we just figured it out, by the way. Like, we made the first radio satellite, so we don't need to do this anymore. We can just have the satellite catch the signal and send it back down to Earth, you know? Right. It's kind of goofy.
Oh, well.
I'm actually surprised that if there was that many hundreds of millions of needles that there wasn't more concern about all the stuff we were launching in the late 60s and early 70s colliding with them, you know, because it was 50 per square mile. Isn't that a pretty good chance that you might actually really not a good chance at all, but no.
And even if it would, I think especially like nose cones and things like that are pretty tough, they're pretty hard materials in order for them to be temperature resistant, so I don't think it would create any damage.
Speaking of nose cones, did you see that Artemis 1 there was the test mission for Artemis 1 last December, and they're going through the test results of how the materials held up on that capsule. And I think they're saying like the heat shields and stuff did not react the way they expected. Like a couple of them kind of flew off, some bad stuff.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
It's not something to be worried about because these are the times to catch problems anyway, and we flew that with the intention to catch problems like that. So if you're reading about, you know, significant safety concerns from Artemis 1 results and stuff like that, it's like, yeah, no, that was kind of what we were going for. I got a couple other interesting facts about radio frequencies and communications, in case you want to rip through them.
Hit me.
Like we mentioned at the top of the episode, the ionosphere has more free electrons during the day because the sun is energizing it, pelting it with UV. What else would it be? UV and X-ray. There are only 100 defined AM frequencies in the United States. However, there are more than 5,000 AM radio stations. How do they do that, right? Well, at night, when the sun goes away and that lower band of the ionosphere reconfigures, meaning more of the signals go up to that high band and will spread further, right? Radios work better at night. We actually shut down or put more of the AM stations into low power mode, so that they don't basically run into each other and create a muddy mess of radio when you're listening at night.
Interesting. Cool.
So there's not a lot of stations that will stay on at night, AM, late at night.
Yeah.
Also, if you're listening to this on Spotify, Apple Music, whatever, we're not on live radio, so you have to be listening over the internet. You are listening to information that was encoded within the radio window, meaning it got passed up to a satellite through line of sight transmission, and then the satellite is the thing that redistributes it, not any part of the atmosphere. Otherwise, it would float aimlessly out into space. We talked about how AM radio shuts down at night. FM does not need this because they do line of sight transmission, meaning the way they distribute their signals is all based on the height of the transmission towers or the transmission power, or that's why you can kind of keep your FM radio stations within your state, is because we have different controls we can put in place to just shoot as far as we can on land. We're not trying to go up and then bounce off of anything. You talked about how FM radios get caught by cars, right, and tune into that frequency.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that's specific to FM radio.
It picks out the frequency that it wants based on, because this is FM, so it picks out the amplitude that it wants. If it's an FM wave, that means we're looking at the differences in frequency, meaning we have to have a constant amplitude so that we can make sure that we're looking at the same wave. And so we're vibrating our antenna at that amplitude to catch the wave and then decode the frequency into an electrical current, which our stereos use to make sound.
There's also a way that radio waves get distributed besides getting caught by satellites or by bouncing off of the ionosphere. And that is what's called tropospheric ducting. So within the climate of the entire globe, there are temperature gradients and humidity changes and atmosphere conditions that can actually catch and guide radio waves of certain frequencies to other parts of the world. It's typically a prominent way of transmission around the coast because that's where there's a lot of temperature clashes between the water and what's on land.
Right.
The last interesting fact I have is that, so we talked about at the start, the higher the frequency on the electromagnetic spectrum, the more likely you are to run into actual physical matter and be stopped, right? That's why light, which is really high compared to radio waves, is going to get blocked by a wall versus a radio frequency can go through a wall. So my question for you is, if I wanted to communicate with a submarine, am I going to want to use a high frequency or a low frequency?
You want to use a low frequency?
Extremely low frequency, yeah. Right. We use something even less than 1 millihertz, which is really, I think these wavelengths, let me just look it up because this has got to be interesting. But so 300 meters is the wavelength of these less than 1 millihertz communications to submarines. And you know how they make these? Because it's hard to make something with that low frequency. They've done experiments in Wisconsin about this kind of stuff where they will create antennas that are miles long, underground antennas that are miles long so that they're actually able to generate such low frequencies. And so these experiments that were happening up in Wisconsin were actually able to communicate with submarines on the other side of the world. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
Those frequencies encoded with ones and zeros will pass through the ground, the crust of the earth, through water, get caught by a submarine, and then it's clean enough to get read back and turn into sound.
Wow,
so
cool.
What's a pun for water and the episode? I was thinking like, and that really let that sink in.
Sure.
Yeah.
I like that.
I like that a lot too. That really brings us to the end of Project Westford, Jed.
No, it's really interesting. I learned a lot. In researching for the episode, I think it's cool. We've talked a lot about how military innovations or military, you know, advancements have driven innovation and how we can use those advancements eventually once they're declassified to improve human life, you know, everyday life.
Yeah.
So I guess hearing about this one was kind of cool because, like AJ said, you're listening to this because we're transmitting data through the atmosphere right now to listen to this episode. So
otherwise, and if you're listening to this in a different country, if this was the 60s, sorry, no way you're hearing it. You know, radio, we didn't have that back then.
Through the underwater cable, maybe.
Through the underwater cable, maybe. Thanks to these 21st century advancements, we're just rocking on all frequencies right now, to be honest. So, that brings us to the end of the episode. A couple of things I want to highlight, which would be one, if you go on shoppocketscience.com, bunch of merch on there that you guys should be checking out. We're planting 3 trees with literally every single product that we sell, which I think is an awesome initiative. 3 trees over its entire lifetime will capture more than 10,000 pounds of CO2. So if you want a sweet way to make a big difference by doing something small, head over there. We'll have the link on our link tree in the episode description. Otherwise, a huge thanks to T.O. For producing our music. You can also find the link to his Spotify at the end of this episode. Absolutely in love with all the music he makes. I've talked to him. He's an awesome guy too. So that's a bonus. And now I think we should jump into a listener shout out.
Let's do it.
Let's do it. Today's listener shout out is from Evie from England. Boom. I love an international listener. I love when we find out that we have other people listening. I mean, we already knew this. We talked about it in the Spotify Wrapped, but England. Evie from England. She says, I listen to your podcast every night before I go to sleep on my second round of listening to each episode. That's pretty awesome.
Jeez. Okay.
I think Evie is in a pretty unique position right now as not many people will be dedicated enough to want to listen to us twice.
Yeah.
I think she would be a great candidate to reach out to us on Instagram or whatever, or our email, and tell us things we could do better. I think she just knows us on a better level than we may even know ourselves in terms of how we make these episodes.
She'll probably catch a lot of mistakes and stuff from you. So she'll probably, yeah.
From me?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah. Evie is out here doing great work. I added a new question to the listener shout out, which is, do you have any topic you're interested to hear about in the future? She says, I would honestly listen to you speak about anything. So, Jed, if you could speak about anything, what are we talking to Evie about?
I don't know. I mean, there's so many. We have a long list of episode topics, and we've been recommended a lot.
And we will always have a long list of episodes, unfortunately.
Maybe, and I know one that we've been putting to the side, we've been wanting to make sure we do it right, has been string theory, because...
Yeah, that and...
We should do it.
Entanglement, and yeah. Yeah, okay, if we're talking about anything...
I think this summer, this is finals week. Maybe it's finals week for some of you as well, so... We're getting down to the end of school, so now that we won't have school, this summer will be a good chance to sit down and try to understand string theory.
Evie says she listens to this before bed, so if we want to help her go to sleep, then we'll start
keep her
there.
Up all yeah. night. She'll be quite pondering her existence.
Well, thank you again, Evie. We love hearing from good listeners like yourself, and I would even venture to say that she is a great listener. Second round.
Yeah.
I'm still stunned that somebody could listen to us one time through and then say, you know what, that wasn't half bad. Let's do it again.
It'd probably help because, I mean, some of the stuff we say doesn't even make sense to us. So if you're able to listen to it twice, you probably get a better understanding.
She probably knows more than us, to be honest.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that brings us to the end of the episode. I want to say thanks again to T.O. I want to say thanks again to Evie. And I want to mention that you guys should go check out shoppocketscience.com. Oh, also, our show name will be changing in about 30 days. You're still going to be able to, if I do this right, you should be able to still find us by looking up University on Spotify. And I know a bunch of you guys are excited about the change. And anybody who's listening to this when we're still University, again, we've got plenty of weeks out before that happens. But you guys are the real veteran listeners.
I just realized that in the intro, we still said University.
Well, because we're not Pocket Science yet. I'm right, giving okay. people, what do you call it, like a...
So what are we going to change?
A grace period.
We're just going to say Pocket Science instead of University. I don't know. We'll take some suggestions on what our new intro should be. I think it should. We still want to keep our slogan.
Oh yeah, Earth Existence in the Unknown.
It's necessary.
That is our bread and butter, really.
If you got any other play on words though with Pocket Science, let us know.
Yeah, or if you want to create a rap, you know.
Mm.
No. To go over T.O.'s lyrics, I just want Judd leading us into Pocket Science, Rocket Science. Socket Science.
All right.
Anyway, so yeah, Pocket Science about 6 weeks out. Excited about that. And anyway, thanks for tuning in. Really, I actually, one more thing.
Okay. On top of the three other one more thing, sure.
Well, it's always one more thing, right? I'm not saying it's the final one more thing, sure. But I will say now one final thing.
One final one thing. Okay.
We are, I think, literally like six reviews or ratings on Spotify away from having more ratings than NASA's Curious Universe podcast. We've already passed their Houston, we have a podcast. We passed that one. And so their last podcast that they have, we're like seven ratings away from it. And I'm just thinking, how awesome is it that we could produce a more well-established radio show than the government who pays people. We don't get paid. We do this like...
Is it awesome? Let's think about it for a second. So instead of going to the PhD professionals for their science news, they're coming here.
Yes. How much more relatable are we? Anyway.
More relatable, yes.
Not more, to...
We tried. We are... I would claim to say that we're accurate. 99.9% of the time.
We work hard to deliver you. We want to be on the same wavelength as you guys. No pun intended. So yeah, go. If you're on Spotify right now, drop down to our show and leave us a rating so that we can pass the number. For no other reason besides me wanting to see Rhyme that we are passing up NASA. That's just cool to me. That's like some kids from the Midwest.
Yep.
Here we are. Anyway, we've got a good community. I like it. All right, guys, take care. We'll see you in 2 weeks to talk about something we haven't even decided on yet. Not 2 weeks. We're going to take a break here.
Okay.
Go be like Evie and re-listen to some old episodes, and we'll be back in touch right in June.
Peace.
Liftoff.